All well, we called you a chicken,
and that
was the snark did take its toll.
What a terrible burden.
Fruit basket
sent by a noble strapping lad, caught in the haze of Manhattan's maze, coming from a forest with three cheap corners.
What the hell's going on, Bill? Where's Jorge?
I'm not sure if you've heard, but we're under the gun from this Love Grossman guy, so we hired the three cheap tenors again. They're actually cheaper than you.
Well,
can you sing
no,
that?
No, but that's not what I'm here for.
Yes, I thought so.
Who's this Grossman character?
He's a guy who writes for Time magazine. Everything's okay, but we just had to respond. He had a few problems with some of the content that Ed Champion put up.
Ed? Ed who?
You really haven't been paying attention. Champion, the guy who's paying us. You know those checks we kind of slip under your door at 2 a.m. per your instructions? Look, if you just get into the booth and sip your tequila, I'm sure it will become as clear as a white t-shirt worn by Howard Hughes.
But we have a big guest this week.
Yeah, I know. Big Vic Navasky.
You can't be nonchalant about this guy. He knows people.
Right.
Oh, just play the damn clip. I can't work in these conditions.
So I am here with Victor Navasky, the author of A Matter of Opinion, which is somewhere between, I guess, a memoir and a kind of history to some degree of your tenure as editor and publisher of The Nation. How are you doing, Victor?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Well, first off, I wanted to talk about one of the really sort of interesting aspects of this book, which was how you describe the sort of strange and often serendipitous economics of opinion journal publishing. You point out, for example, that The Nation, throughout its 141-year-old history, has only actually been profitable for 3 years. I'm not sure if things have changed after 95 or not, but and you've also attracted investors such as Paul Newman and former publisher Arthur Carter with a prospectus that promises that, well, we might actually break even in 3 years. So I wanted to talk about how you have been able to sort of remain in business despite having a very economically, not a very economically viable position, and what causes so many people to invest in The Nation with a magazine that's always losing money.
Okay. First of all, in the magazine business, the ultimate test of success is survival. Mm-hmm. The Nation was founded on July 6, 1865. It's America's oldest weekly magazine. It has survived where magazines with circulations in the millions, like Life and Look and the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, went under. So by that test, even though it's lost money for 141 years, it's America's most successful magazine. Now, we didn't start losing money when I got there. The proprietors always regarded it as a public trust, and it's more a cause than a business, which is why they're still in business. If they had treated it like a business, in my view, the first thing that you would do would be to try to moderate its tone so you make it less problematic for advertisers. Second thing is you'd slick up the paper. You know, it looks like butcher paper now. Calvin Trillin once said it's the only magazine on the Tonight Show. Said it's the only magazine where the Xerox looks better than the original. You slick up the paper so that you could get full color pictures in there, again, for advertising. And if you did all those things, you'd become more and more like everybody else, and there'd be less and less reason for you to be in business. And unless you were a real success, and then you would be swallowed up by some conglomerate, and the investors would get very rich, but you'd disappear, which is the reason they got involved in the first place, since if they were interested in money, they could throw a dart at the listing on the New York Stock Exchange, and whichever stock they hit would be a better bet than a magazine like The Nation or, you know, any journal of opinion. They all have lost money. Now, for years, we had a very bad joke, and our joke was, if it's bad for the country, it's good for the nation. And people say, how are you doing now? I say, better than ever. And the truth is, the last 3 years, the magazine made a little money. So I had to send a letter of apology to our shareholders, because I promised them they'd get a tax loss.
So that's the real sort of secret then.
Well, they really do it because they believe in it. And if I took a vote among them, if we made a little money next year, and I said, hey, we can send you a dividend, or we can reinvest it in the magazines to strengthen its outreach and, you know, build its audience and pay its writers a little better. Which would you prefer? With one exception, they'd all vote to do the first.
Well, under your watch, too, the nation has gone from 20,000 to nearly 200,000 subscribers, if not, I think it's like hovering at around 181,000 right now.
Well, it's closer to 200, actually.
Okay, okay. But still, that's like a difference between 60,000 at $30 a pop, or 600,000 versus 6 million. So, despite this kind of like rise in subscription, why has, what, where does this money go to? I mean, that's kind of the one weird thing about, you know, what accounts for this discrepancy? The general economics, the sort of variegated staff that's on the nation.
Or? What I'm not sure what discrepancy.
I'm just wondering.
I mean, why don't we have 6 million readers or what?
No. What I'm wondering though is that you're talking about sort of a revenue that comes from subscribers that goes from 600,000 to 6 million. So there's a considerable difference there between 600,000 and 6 million. So what happens to the kind of, you know, this extra cash that kind of that has happened?
I'm talking about a magazine that used to lose $500,000 a year and that now more or less breaks even. And we've stopped losing the $500,000 a year. To run a magazine that does about, the nation does about $10 or $11 million worth of business a year now, it's very expensive. Number one, you have to do a lot of direct mail, and the mailing rates keep going up and up. Number two, paper costs go up. Number three, printing costs go up. Number four, we have a very generous and good health plan for our employees. They're unionized, and the union demands go up as you do better and better, and they deserve. The staff deserves to be well paid. They're not paid the way journalists in the mainstream media are, but at the starting levels, it's very good salary level. So all of the costs of running a business are costs that the nation, like every other business in this country, has to bear. We have about 35 people who work there, and so it's no mystery, and we our books are pretty open. So in fact, when I became publisher, I went to the Harvard Business School and spoke to a friend on the faculty and said, if you will make this one of your case studies, I'll open our books to you and give you the problem. How do you take a magazine that's lost money for 130-odd years and without changing the magazine, turn around its economics? And what he said was, it's a great idea for a case study, but not for our MBA students. But we have a program that meets for 3 weeks a year for 3 years for owners and presidents, CEOs of small businesses, and we could make you a case study for them, and you could come up one day and you'd get 100 free consultants. But the other thing you might want to do is think about taking it for yourself, because you don't know what you're doing. And in the end, that's what I did. And so,
well, I asked this question because you're so forthright in the book,
sure,
probably more so than most newspaper histories or magazine histories that I've read, where you're just, the books are essentially open within the course of the book. And so I'm just trying to, I'm wondering if the nation is kind of this sort of enterprise, essentially, that kind of feeds whatever money it can back into like these direct mail campaigns.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And the writers' rates have gone up despite Calvin Trillin's libels across the country. Actually, it's plagiarism, not libel. He goes around saying that we're paying him in the high two figures. And in fact, that was my line, not his line. I told him we were thinking of paying him in the high two figures when he first had the bad taste to raise the issue of compensation when we went to lunch where I invited him to write a humor column for us. And we ended up paying him $100 a column, not a penny more or a penny less. So.
Well, you also, your idea, of course, was the no diddling policy.
Well, he made two conditions. One was what he called the no diddling clause, yes, which was that I want to be edited, he said, but I don't want you to change a word without my okay. And he, we've been true to that, and so has he. And then the other was that he's allowed to make fun of the editor. So I invited him to be my guest.
Well, shifting away from the rather turgid waters of capitalism, I did actually want to bring up a review that Matthew Rothschild wrote in The Progressive. He's the editor of The Progressive.
Yeah.
And he suggested that it was odd for you in this book to be more proud of fundraising than the actual magazine itself. And he even called you a chef who doesn't seem to like to cook. And obviously he comes from the standpoint of a competitor, but actually I wanted to get your take on this because he does actually have a certain point. Yeah. I mean, your book kind of glosses over some of the journalistic aspects. Like, for example, David Corn broke the news on the Valerie Plame scandal.
Yeah, well,
and do you feel that, you know, maybe you can respond to this? What, where does content weigh in with the sort of the financial shenanigans?
Right. Well, I think I have a lot of respect for the Progressive. Of course, Matt is an editor, and I was the editor for 16 years, and then I was a publisher for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I had the burden of raising the $500,000 a year deficit and turning the thing around. And I also believe that the economics of these magazines are part of their story and an untold part of their story. And it seemed to me it was very important to include that in there. On the other hand, I'm very proud of our editorial accomplishments, and a lot of people think that I've gone on at too great length about them, and as you know, having read the thing, the book is also about my life at the New York Times and also at Monocle magazine, which I founded, and at the Times, of course, and about life as a freelance writer and all of the mistakes that I've made over the years in covering people ranging from Hubert Humphrey and Larry O'Brien, Democratic Convention, and all of that. But I think, you know, Matt, since his is a journal of opinion, he certainly is entitled to his opinion. But, you know, I think the discussions about whether these magazines, as a class, not just The Nation, but The Progressive and others, preach to the choir or not, for example, is to me a critical part of the book and a reason that I wrote it, and a false rap, I believe, that anyone who reads our letters page will see that if it preaches to the choir, it's the least harmonious choir in the history of choral music, that we broke the story about the Swiss a Swiss journalist broke the story about Bertelsmann, which is one of the largest publishers in the world, and claimed that it closed down during the Nazi period because the government didn't like what it was doing, and in fact it turned out to be publishing books that were used by Hitler's armies and anti-Semitic books and other things, and it became a worldwide story, and it was the result of it was that they appointed a commission that gave a report, and after which they had to apologize and change their story. So I do, you know, try to deal with a lot of significant things here. On the one hand, the other hand, I didn't sit down to write a history of The Nation.
Yeah.
Sat down to do a sort of meditation on the role of journals of opinion. And midway, my publisher turned the magazine over to me, Arthur Carter, and so I changed it from a third-person misadventure story to a first-person, or from a third-person meditation to a first-person misadventure story. My son read all the three pages when I finished the draft and said, "I get it, it's a how not to." So, and, you know, David is a great correspondent. He didn't actually break the Valerie claim story. What he did was he was the first reporter to point out that that Evans may have, or somebody may have, violated the Agents Identities Protection Act, and there might be criminal consequences as a result of it. At the time, until that time, no one had written about that. Subsequently, a special prosecutor was appointed, and the rest is sort of history. So,
I wanted to also see, you know, you suggest midway through the book that, for example, The Nation's, and we were kind of talking about this earlier, that The Nation's name brand kind of allows for its endurance, allows for it to survive, allows for it to kind of maintain its legacy. And I wanted to ask you about this. Is this what it kind of takes, particularly today, is like, you know, subscription rates, not in The Nation's case, but certainly in other newspaper rates, start to fall, and as advertisers consider taking their services elsewhere. Is a sort of this kind of niche market what it takes, or is it sort of like, you know, kind of, I mean, are there enough kind of eccentric investors or people who view The Nation as a cause who are willing to go ahead and take this on?
Well, as I said earlier, over the years, certainly, especially when it was losing money, yes, the answer is yes. It's not that they're eccentric, it's that they care, and they are socially engaged people who understand that the mainstream media is not telling the full story. Mm-hmm. And they think it's healthy for, in a democratic society, to have a paper, in this case a magazine, that's in the business of questioning the official line and looking at the and trying to understand the underlying meaning of the news. It's the fact that the nation has been around so long. It was founded the year the Civil War ended, so means that it writ large, it's an alternative history of the United States, and some people sort of subliminally, intuitively understand that and care about it, maybe more than a magazine that started yesterday, and they see it as a place that's important to keep going. But right now we're in a period where, as we discussed, where it sort of pays its own way in the world, so that's not the issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, aside from the nation's financial situation, you also place emphasis on, and I was going to mention this, certain governmental factors that kind of influence magazines. You have, for example, the second-class mail situation. You go into the Mother Jones's nonprofit war. What can we do? I guess, do you have any sort of thoughts on how magazines can kind of operate under these kinds of stringent sort of governmental circumstances?
Well, second-class mail is only... I mean, second-class mail is important because founding fathers had a very different philosophy than American capitalism has today. George Washington thought newspapers, which were then journals of opinion, should be delivered free of charge. Mm-hmm. Ben Franklin, who was Postmaster General, delivered magazines free of charge. Thomas Jefferson thought that Tom Paine should be made Postmaster General, who wrote these great pamphlets, Common Sense and all that. They understood that the journal of opinion was sort of part of the circulatory system of a democratic society. And they thought it was like water, a public good that shouldn't have to pay its own way in the mails, that you do everything you can to get these kinds of ideas distributed. And since those days, in the Nixon years, Congress passed a law saying every class of mail has to pay its own way in the post office. And ironically, the Magazine Publishers Association, which ought to be representing the interests of the little guys as well as the big guys, ends up going before the Postal Rate Commission and saying, hey, we understand why you have to raise rates because the cost of transportation has gone up, the cost of labor has gone up. But if we print it near where we mail it and we actually deliver bundles already wrapped by zip code, can't we get lower rates? And the Postal Rate Commission says, okay. But of course, small journals, not just The Nation, but their magazines with circulations of 400, 700, can't afford to do that.
Sure.
And so ironically, the bigger they are and the more successful commercially they are, the more subsidy they get from the government. So that's one kind of government thing that you want to fight against. And the media and democracy, there's a new media and democracy group that is working against it. But more importantly, the government, this particular administration, has engaged in a series of assaults on information itself that has very dire consequences for journalism and ultimately for our country. They've rolled back the Freedom of Information Act. They've reclassified government documents that were declassified in the past. They have... yesterday, the representative Peter King from New York, I'm sorry to say, called for the criminal prosecution of the New York Times because it ran a story about government surveillance of financial transactions. They have bribed journalists with grants in this country, and they put journalists in Iraq on the secret dole. They have behaved as if a free press were their enemy, when in fact a free press is a guarantor of a free society.
Well, it's interesting, though, looking at this kind of history of second-class mail. It's been relatively, I guess, as inexorable as living up to the nation's motto, which is like, you know, we shall not be an organ for any party or any candidate. There are a lot of sort of parallels. One might also kind of, you know, point out, it's sort of almost like a constitution, the whole nation's motto. Where do you kind of deviate from, I guess, the original sort of tenets that were laid down in 1865? I mean, how do you make a decision to, you know, kind of be flexible with these ever-changing times? I mean,
well, one of the things that Karen McWilliams, who was a great editor of the magazine, used to say was that Godkin, the founding editor, was a genius, and his formula still works today, which is you try to explain the underlying meaning of the news, and you have a periodical that is very inexpensive to produce, so you don't overlay it with fancy production costs, and you're not advertising dependent, even though we take ads, happy to get them. We're happy to attack our advertisers too. We don't compromise the values of the magazine in order to keep them. But the politics of the magazine over the years have zigged and zagged. For example, in the beginning, they were a free trade magazine. They were anti-trade union. Women's rights meant very little to them. And then, some point in the early 1900s, they started running very advanced articles on feminist issues. One of the first women who owned and edited a magazine in this country was Frieda Kirschwey, who the magazine's policy on Israel has changed. Of course, Israel has changed, but under Frieda Kirschwey's editorship, she was a lobbyist and intervener on behalf of the creation of the State of Israel. And we're committed to the security and survival of the State of Israel, but we're very critical of the policies of especially the, you know, right-wing Israeli governments. And so on a whole range of issues over the years, it has moved here and there. And yet it has been pretty consistent in its support of civil rights, human rights, and civil liberties, although there was a period during World War II where the magazine came out for certain kinds of limitations on free speech, which we wouldn't do today, I think. And it's been pretty consistent in its criticism of imperial and colonial adventures.
I guess, though, the question I had is sort of, where is the line drawn between, I guess, criticizing a political figure or urging, like, Nader not to run, and actually sort of espousing, you know, the whole we shall not be an organ for anyone? Where did you draw the line in the sand on that?
Well, I think the line is that, let's say that you think the country will be a lot better off if George Bush did not get reelected president last time. And you also think, and so you, Ralph Nader, who wrote his first article for The Nation magazine, we write an open letter to Ralph Nader saying, hey, Ralph, you know, your ideas, we agree with 100%, but running for president isn't the way to enact them. In fact, last time you may have helped, not been the cause of, but the way a lot of other people accuse him of being, but helped Al Gore lose and given us his president. And there is a difference between those two guys. But here's where you draw the line to me. If you catch Al Gore with his hand in the till while he's running for president, you don't not publish that story because you think he'd make a better president than George Bush. If you're in the business of working for Al Gore, yeah, then everything you do, you judge by whether it's good or bad for the campaign. As a magazine, you have a higher sense of obligations, and it's not you're not in the propaganda business, you're in the truth-telling business.
But at the same time, what makes The Nation's approach different from any sort of newspaper or alt-weekly? I mean, an alt-weekly might offer sort of an endorsement of a candidate, but if they, of course, decide or discover that the actual candidate has his hand in the proverbial cookie jar, then I'm sure they're going to run a story,
yes,
too. So what makes The Nation different in this sense of not being an organ or, you know, being a truth-teller? I mean, I'm just, maybe you can elaborate.
Well, what makes it different from an alternative weekly?
An alternative weekly or a newspaper, yeah, who offers endorsements every November.
Yeah.
For
Well, I think that most, we'll start with the mainstream press.
Yeah.
Most mainstream press, and here I include not just New York Times and the Washington Post, but Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the television networks, they insist that they don't have any ideology. And a magazine like The Nation is open about its ideology. My view is Nation has the ideology of the left, National Review has the ideology of the right, the center media have the ideology of the center. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the ideology of the center to deny that you have an ideology. So the so one major difference is that you share with your readers your political values so they know where you're coming from. And you don't have this pretense of objectivity that the mainstream media cultivates. And it also dictates the way stories are written, and both the form and to a degree the content. So that's, to me, a significant difference. Difference between the Nation and alternative media essentially is probably that we give more space and have a little bit more of a systematic approach to issues of policy and politics than some of the kind of existential periodicals out there.
But at the same time, the risk of this is that you lose a guy like Christopher Hitchens, who you speak of quite lovingly, I think,
yeah,
in this book. You know.
Well, we didn't fire Christopher because he violated some party line, which we don't have. He quit because he wasn't comfortable writing in a magazine. Uncharacteristically, by the way, he called this column Minority of One, a Minority Report. Yeah. It was inspired by an old magazine called Minority of One. But one would wish that he would have stuck around and had the argument in our pages. Instead, he went off and he writes for Vanity Fair and the Atlantic Monthly, and more power to him. This week, his article in Vanity Fair is on blowjobs.
Yes.
But anyway, too bad that he's not with us. But
did you ever try to coax him back? Or?
Well, we invited him to come back at the time in print.
Yeah.
Said and predicted that he'd come back at the time in print, and I did privately tell him. He said, "No, the only question is why I didn't quit sooner." He resented something I wrote about him on the occasion of his offering to testify against his friend Sidney Blumenthal on the question of what Sidney had or hadn't said to him and his wife in a restaurant about Monica Lewinsky, and there was a perjury charge up there because Sidney said that when he told reporters that she was stalking the president, this wasn't on orders from the White House, he was doing this on his own, and he had picked that up. Everybody was saying it, and he had heard it from 18 different places. And Christopher, when he offered to testify that he said he was told this by someone in the White House, we wrote a editorial I did raising the question about whether that was an appropriate thing to do. This is based on my own study of the McCarthy period and my own attitude towards congressional investigations of that sort, which I considered wrecking expeditions, and the Kenneth Starr investigation had some of the aspects of the old McCarthy investigations, it seemed to me. And so I actually, without success, attempted to talk to Christopher in advance of writing that. He was beleaguered with phone calls. But he didn't like that. He didn't like the magazine's position, or what he thought was the magazine's position. He actually overstated it, because we had a debate within the magazine on the first Gulf War, and so he said it, he didn't feel like it was his home anymore.
We were running out of time rather rapidly, but I wanted to actually ask you one final question.
Sure.
About you remain very optimistic about the future of print journalism in the afterword, but of online journalism, you write, "The depositing of prose in electronic databases cannot compete with the canonization, the legitimization conferred by those old-fashioned print journals, at least not in contemporary cultural items." Well, I'd like to actually turn the question back and say, what of Salon? What of Slate? What of the number of online outlets? It was, for example, the James Frye memoir. That was broken by the Smoking Gun.
Yeah,
the
right.
Smoking Gun.
Right.
So,
well, my interns at The Nation and my own children tell me I don't get it, so maybe I don't. But I believe that, first of all, the new media, for years, they were ushered in with the prediction that they were going to replace print and that print is dead. The novel is dead. The book is dead. The magazine is dead. Well, I believe that they are going to be like the paperback is to the hardcover rather than the talking movie is to silent movies. They're not going to put them out of business. They're going to extend the audience for them. And for the reasons that some of which you quoted there. Without question, I think in the long run, it's a very healthy thing that you have the ability to have this exchange and back and forth with your readers, viewers, whatever you want to call them. And you have interactivity and you have links that print doesn't provide. And that's a terrific thing. In the short run, yes, but in addition to Slate and Salon kept being in death throes, and Slate, we still don't know whether it's being subsidized by Microsoft or it's successful enterprise, but yeah, or the Post these days. But they, it seemed to me that it helped degrade mainstream journalism by speeding up the news cycle. At the same time, it had no fact checking out there, and that for the characteristic player for a long time seemed to be Matt Drudge rather than Michael Kinsley. And but I'm cheering for it to succeed. New technologies, however, always have unintended cultural consequences. McLuhan was brilliant in pointing out some of them, and we don't yet understand the cultural consequences of the blogosphere.
Well, I mean, it's had some results. I mean, Dan Rather was forced to step down because of the right-wing blogs, and
well,
you know,
I don't, yeah, see,
the,
I don't,
the Oprah show. Yeah.
Well, the blogs turned out to be wrong about Rather, half of them, although they may have played a role in it. So, but I don't consider that a healthy thing. If you get fired or eased out because the impression is abroad that you did something that you didn't do, then it's a question. So the interesting thing is they appointed a commission to look into Rather. Commission reports back, and they say, "Well, we have no evidence that, you know, that this was a forged document." The blogosphere said that it was proved to be a forged document. Well, it wasn't, and then the commission that his own organization appointed wouldn't say that. Now they criticized him for the methodology and all of that, but so.
But what I'm suggesting, though, is that. Even so, the information is out there that can, in fact, be verified. So instead, it's kind of like a kind of...
No, but you're not saying that, yeah, it's great to put out false information because you can prove that it's false and other people can prove that it's false. So the question is, yeah, is there anything intrinsic about the blogosphere that makes its information better or worse, or is it all the same, all neutral? And I don't know that there's anything intrinsic to it other than this kind of rush to... publication, as it were. You know, as soon as something comes out, you put it out there. There also is a stylistic difference. No one has written a PhD about it yet, yeah. But I think I know, as you probably know, that style is different on blogs than in print. And people take more care in print, for better or worse. And there's an informality on blogs, which is refreshing. And there's a lack of capitalization, which is sort of funny to see sometimes. There used to be writers in the Village Voice. There used to be a dance critic who never used any punctuation. You know, it made it a little harder to read, but she was distinctive.
Well, at the same time, though, one might argue that blogs are, in a sense, the new opinion journals.
Well, I think to some extent they are. And then the question is, are they as valuable as the old ones? And will they put the old ones out of business? And again, I'm one of those who believes, no, they won't. But more power to them. Let's have them out there, and let's, you know, let good speech and blog speech, old-fashioned journal opinion speech and blog speech go up against each other and see how it all shakes out.
I guess
sure.
I'm coming from the perspective, though, of someone who also is a blogger as well, and, yeah. And there's this animosity on the side of, like, you know, print journalists looking at blogs saying, oh, well, this is, you know, useless, but, you know, the people who read the blogs can make the decision of, like, okay, this is credible information because it's backed up. This person has sourced out the actual fact they're trying to do. So, I mean, based off of that, I mean, why do you think print journalism has this animosity? Or maybe you can provide some perspective as a part of.
Well, I think what I have seen both at the Nation actually, but at the Columbia Journalism Review where I chair the thing, and I've spoken to others in other news organizations. There is a culture clash between the new media people and the old-fashioned media people. But I've seen it the other way. I've seen some of the new media, like I was talking to someone who works for a huge company, and he says, you know, you don't understand, there's a revolution going on. The people in the techies have contempt for the old-fashioned journalists. They talk about them as brand managers, the content people. They talk about editors as brand managers. Well, so it goes both ways. There's a culture clash. I think it'll all work itself out, and every time a new medium comes along, there are some of that. I think back in the days of the ancient Greeks, there was a prediction that print would drive conversation out of business because, you know, so.
Well, we'll have to broker a detente at some future time. Victor,
great.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. It was great.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Great. Terrific.